KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's opening hour this morning, we begin our election coverage of state propositions that are on your November ballot with focus in the first half of the hour on Proposition 1A, which asks voters to approve nearly $10 billion in bonds for the construction of a high-speed rail system, the largest proposed public works project in California's history. In the bottom of the hour, we'll discuss Proposition 4, which will also appear on your November ballot, which would make parental notification a requirement for teens who seek an abortion. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Proposition 1A on the November 4th California state ballot would approve the sales of $9.95 billion in bonds to begin the construction of an 800-mile high-speed rail system that would take passengers in its main line from San Francisco to Los Angeles in just 2.5 hours. Those opposed say the state can't afford what many of them, in fact, are calling a boondoggle. And in this first half hour, we want to discuss the initiative. Joining us from the South Bay, from San Jose, is Rod Diridon. He is executive director of the Mineta Transportation Institute in San Jose and a former member of the Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors, also a board member of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. And welcome, Rod Diridon.
Nice to be here, Michael.
Nice to have you here. We also have Adrian Moore, who's with us from the state capitol in Sacramento, vice president of the Reason Foundation, a free market think tank that's based in Los Angeles. He has a PhD in transportation economics, and he is also project manager on the report released today called California High-Speed Rail Proposal Due Diligence Report. And welcome, Adrian Moore.
Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to have you both here. And Rod Diridon, let me begin with you. Well, these are economic hard times, and yet I guess from your perspective, this is the right time with the governor behind this proposal and the right time for other reasons. What are the main reasons we need high-speed rail now?
Well, we're going to double in size in the state of California by the year 2050 in terms of population. And to accommodate that growth and trip requirement and to still be able to bring people to and from work and products to and from the marketplace, we have to have a world-class transportation system. The rest of the world is going to high-speed rail. 13 other countries in the world have gone to high-speed rail, and every other industrialized country now is either planning or building. And some non-industrialized country like Mexico and Algeria and others. So we're lagging way behind in terms of that proven, very efficient, and environmentally clean mode of transportation. We have a short time now to catch up. We've done the studies that are required by the federal government over the last 10 years and now can proceed into the development of that system with a significant amount of federal and private investment. The California investment is only about one-third of the total cost. So it's time if we're going to provide the service when it's needed by this increased population.
Well, the opposition, and we'll hear from Adrian Moore in a moment, is saying, as I'm sure you're well aware, that perhaps that investment money is not necessarily going to be there, nor the federal money, and that this is too costly. Estimates are going to soar like they did with the Bay Bridge.
Well, the studies that have been done by the High-Speed Rail Authority, and these have been done by competitively selected top consultants, have indicated that there will be private investment when the time comes. In fact, we've got letters from 40 different international investment organizations indicating they want to invest in the system when the investment opportunity occurs. And there's a bill now pending in Congress by two bills, one by Chair Oberstar of the House Transportation and Infrastructure and the other by our own Chair Barbara Boxer of the Senate Side Committee on transportation authorization that would create the funding that's necessary based on tax credits.
Have you figured in security costs?
Yes, security is a major element of it, and indeed, we don't have to reinvent the wheel there. Other countries have much more serious problems with security than we do, and they have developed security systems that we will replicate.
Adrian Moore, is the main opposition because of what you feel the costs will be on this?
Well, cost is just one factor. As Rod points out, there's high-speed rail systems all around the world, so we can look at them and have a pretty good idea of how they work. I used to live in Germany, and I've ridden the European high-speed rail systems, and they're great. And I think high-speed rail might be a great thing for California. But the current proposal that the California High-Speed Rail Authority has put together is essentially saying that we're going to build a train that is faster, will carry more people, will be more efficient, and will have lower fares than any existing high-speed rail system in the world. That seems pretty far-fetched to me and to a lot of other people, I think. And so we looked a few months ago around and saw that all of the research done on this question was by the California High-Speed Rail Authority, which is openly cheerleading for the plan. And we thought, well, usually when you have a system that's going to have a lot of private investment and a lot of public investment, you have, you know, some kind of independent due diligence analysis. And so we decided to do that. So today we're releasing just under 200-page, very detailed analysis of every aspect of this project. And what this finds is that it's not going to be faster, it's not going to carry more people, it's not going to be more efficient, and it's not going to have lower fares than any other high-speed rail system in the
world.
Based on what? It's not going to work.
What kind of empirical evidence is based on that you're saying it's not going to work?
Well, there's two types of evidence. First is actually looking at the California High-Speed Rail Authority's own data and comparing that to the claims that are made. And the second is looking at comparable systems in other part of the world and the kind of results they have. I mean, ridership alone. All of the projections about financing this project depend on having really high ridership, higher ridership than any system in the world. So you look at trains in Western Europe and Japan that carry that travel to very dense urban corridors that are in countries where lots of people already use trains, where there's a much more of a transit use culture than there is in California, and they're not carrying even half the people that the High-Speed Rail Authority claims this California rail line will carry. So, you know, that kind of reality check makes you question these really outrageous ridership numbers.
I'm going to open our phone lines now because we're doing a half hour each this morning on a couple of propositions, and this is an opportunity for you to join in here if you have something you'd like to say about the whole prospect of building high-speed rail here in California. We're talking about the proposition that will be on your November ballot, Proposition 1A, which would indeed provide the construction funds for that for bond money. And you can join us and are welcome to do so. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Lines are open to you, and now is the time if you have something to say or to ask. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. Let me go back to Rod Dearadan. Essentially, I think we talked about this back in May, you may recall, Rod, and
yes,
came up even back then that the projections, I think the word was at the time was laughable, the projections of ridership. And again, what's your evidence to prove otherwise?
Well, Michael, we've hired the best consultants we can find in the world in a competitive bid process. And those consultants, two different economic consultants, have come up with similar projections. Charles River Associates, both of them very conservative, by the way, Charles River Associates and Cambridge Systematics. They're bondworthy fiscal and economic consultants. They've done the analysis. They can come forward with the projections, and we trust those projections. The interpretation of those projections by the Reason Foundation have been notoriously inaccurate. And, you know, as Adrian suggests, the High-Speed Rail Authority is a cheerleader for the project. Certainly we are. But at the other extreme, Adrian's Reason Foundation is a cheerleader for ultra-conservatism. So you've got two extremes here. And somewhere in the middle, probably there's the conclusion, and the conclusion is in favor of high-speed rail. We can't be the only one right in the world and have the whole rest of the world going to high-speed rail when we continue to rely on the automobile and the short-hop airline, two of the most petroleum-dependent, pollution-oriented activities ever created by humankind. We've got to move in the direction the rest of the world is moving, or we're going to fall even further behind the rest of the world in creating a modern transportation system.
Well, let me ask you, Adrian Moore, before we bring our callers into this, what would you do to reduce pollution and global warming? I mean, certainly Rod Dearadan's point is well taken here. As congestion gets worse and as population increases, how many alternatives do we have? Would you put the money into highways, or what would you do?
Well, I mean, we have alternatives. There is a high-speed rail line in the United States, and it runs from Washington, D.C. to Boston, and it doesn't accomplish any of the things that the rail authority claims the one in California will accomplish. And that's between Washington, D.C. and Boston. It goes through New Jersey and New York, and, you know, that's like the densest corridor in the United States. And they're talking about the Central Valley of California through farmland. So, you know, those environmental benefits are not going to be realized. And, in fact, one of the most outrageous examples of how these consultants' analysis, yeah, they may be competitively chosen, but they still work for the cheerleading outfit, and they're providing them the results that they want. Chairman Kopp's been out there saying that the high-speed rail project will account for all of the state's goals in meeting greenhouse gas reductions, which is just ridiculous, because if you actually look at the numbers in the High-Speed Rail Authority's own reports, the high-speed rail will account for 1.5% of the state's goal in greenhouse gas reduction. So it's a tiny, tiny part of the solution for tens of billions of dollars.
All right, I want to bring our callers into this. As I said, we're going to move in another direction at the after the break. And Rebecca, you're first up, and join us, please. Good morning.
Hi there. I have a question about the timeline of this project. When would you start breaking ground, and when would the rail be completed?
Rod Dyrdek.
Rebecca, if the bonds pass in November, and the polls are showing 58% to 60% in favor with only about 30% opposed, so it looks pretty good right now, then the construction would begin. We'll go into final engineering, by the way, the what's called project-level environmental clearance, which leads into final engineering, and we ought to be able to bid the project in 2011 or 12. With the first trains down the tracks, and we'll start in several different places at the same time, beginning in 2018 to 2020.
I think that answers the question, Rebecca, and we thank you for calling. I want to get some more callers on here, and we'll go to David next. David, morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the program.
Thank you.
I had a question with the study. Would the final fare values to, you know, an end user be comparable to the low-cost fares from Southwest Airlines or JetBlue, and are the ridership numbers, you know, the daily rider numbers, have they been projected to be somewhat comparable to what the volume that we have going on today between the Bay Area?
Well, I think our guests see that differently, it's safe to say.
Yeah.
Rod, why don't you point out what you're saying here will take place along those lines, and then we'll hear the rebuttal from Adrian Moore.
First element of the question was what was the projected cost, and we projected the cost. We didn't. The economic organizations projected the cost at roughly 50% of what the average airline ticket was between the metropolitan areas. And so it came out to be about $55 per direction for the high-speed train. And volume of ridership is not all, but a significant portion of the through-trip ridership currently in automobiles and on the short-hop airlines. And that's the way the projections were done by the Cambridge Systematics and Charles River Associates.
And you say what, Adrian Moore?
Well, I'll take them in the opposite order. The plan, the High-Speed Rail Authority's plan, calls not for getting very many of the riders out of the airplanes, but rather for getting the overwhelming majority of the riders out of their cars, which has been, you know, a notoriously unsuccessful strategy in California. The cost, the fares are projected to be about half of what the fares are in all other comparable high-speed rail systems in the world, which means this would have to be more than twice as efficient a high-speed rail system as any high-speed rail line in the world, which I think is highly unlikely.
One of the things that Adrian's not mentioning is the fact that the gas prices have gone through the roof and they're never going to come down to the point where they have been in the past, except for short periods of time when the oil companies tease us into trying to drive our cars again.
But, Rod, they're
and
still
let
much
me,
lower
no, let me
than
finish
they are
my point
in Europe
up,
and Japan.
I'll never interrupt you. If you give me that same courtesy, I'd appreciate it. The second point to recall is that ridership on our current rail systems have gone through the roof. We are currently carrying more people on the Los Angeles corridor than the Northeast corridor, the Acela line. And ridership on our other transportation rail systems in California have gone up dramatically. And by the way, the Central Valley is not a farmland anymore. If you haven't been there recently, you ought to visit, Adrian, because it's rapidly densifying, and it's going to sprawl unless we get rail stations that people can cluster around.
Yeah, you wanted to respond, Adrian Moore.
Well, yeah, I live in the Central Valley, so actually I'm quite familiar with the land use patterns there. And as gas prices are still much lower than these other high-speed rail systems, and yet they don't achieve than in the countries where these other high-speed rail systems are, and they don't achieve this kind of ridership figures. And, yes, ridership on transit systems around the state and the country has exploded with the rising gas prices, which has pushed it up to almost 2% of all travel. So let's say it just continues to explode. It might get up to 5 or 6% of all travel, which still means 95% of all travel is going to be by car. I mean, this is not a panacea. It's not even close to a panacea. And you're talking about spending, you know, a year's budget of the entire state of California to build this system in its ultimate manifestation.
Let me bring more of our callers on here. We go to Oakland. Michelle, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Many things to say. I lived in Japan for 10 years. So when I came back and saw how feeble our public transportation system is and all of the associated costs, well, in fact, just driving back from Los Angeles the other day, I said, what's up with the high-speed rail? How come we don't have one? How do we make it happen? Arguments against it to me, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but when I hear arguments against public transportation, it just baffles my mind. That's all I can say. How do we, the constituents of the United States, get a high-speed rail system in California?
Well, in this instance, you vote for 1A, I guess, would be the simple answer to that, because that's why it's on the ballot. Although there's more than just a high-speed rail that's at stake here on 1A, is there not, Rod Dyrdek?
Well, that's true, Michael, and thank you for stressing that. The $9 billion out of the $9.95 billion goes into the high-speed rail project and will be used only for the high-speed rail project. And by the way, 90% of that must be used for construction. Only 10% can be used for the final engineering and planning. The other point that you were making is that the $950 million left of the $9.95 will go into upgrading the feeder and distribution systems like BART and Caltrain and the Altamont Express and the San Joaquin trains and so on. And those systems badly need improvements and expansions in order to meet their current ridership requirements. So we're killing two birds with one stone, or helping two programs with one measure here. And remember that the $950 million can receive federal matching funds and will. So we're really accomplishing an awful lot with one measure.
It's also safe to say, though, isn't it, Adrian Moore, that your group is concerned just about the cost of repaying these bonds over three decades?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're building infrastructure, and using bonds is not an inappropriate way to build infrastructure. So that's not the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is, you know, the wisdom of that investment versus alternative investments. And, you know, the caller mentioned, the state of public transit. The reason why we oppose a lot of ideas, not all ideas, but a lot of ideas about public transit investments is San Francisco Bay Area right now, the entire metropolitan area, has a 20-year transportation plan that calls for spending 50% of all transportation dollars that will be spent over the next 20 years on public transit. Public transit only carries 8% of the trips. That is an unsustainable situation. You can't spend 50% of the money on 8% of the travel and expect the system not to fall apart. We face that same situation statewide. We've got a transportation system that's falling apart. If my roof is leaking, I need to fix that before I build an add-on to my house. We need to fix our current transportation system before we try to, you know, get out ahead of the curve and be ahead of the rest of the world with an enormously, amazingly expensive public works project.
Let me get some more of your calls on, and we go to San Jose. John, welcome. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, I would love such a system. However, did his consultants really get their facts and state them in light of the last 2 days of the stock market down? And also, aren't bonds sort of like mortgages, and isn't that sort of why we're in debt in the state of California anyway, with a bunch of bonds?
Well, there's no way that you could affect it in the last couple of days, obviously. But, Rod Dyrdek, why don't you address that? Because there are many people who are saying that not only is the state on hard times now, but lately things have been even more fragile economically than anybody had expected.
Well, let me go back to a point that Adrian mentioned a moment ago, which suggests to you how radical his organization is on this issue. He's suggesting that the high-speed rail project is the same as much as the state budget. Well, as a matter of fact, Californians will spend $9.95 billion on the high-speed rail project. The rest of the money will come from the federal government and from private investments, and that's required in the measure. And the state budget is $100 billion. So how ridiculous a statement is that? And what we're seeing here is a comparison of building our rest of our highway systems out, and we don't have the dirt for that. We don't have the money for it. The calculation by the best consultants in the world indicate that if we were to try to handle our transportation requirements by building more highways and airports, it would cost over $100 billion to accomplish the same mobility that our roughly $40 plus billion will accomplish in the high-speed rail program. And we'd have the petroleum dependence continued on our highways and airports when we begin to wean ourselves away from the petroleum dependence and the concomitant air pollution by going to the high-speed rail program. So it's really a completely different shift. And to say that you don't want to fund high-speed rail because people aren't using mass transportation is the same thing as saying I've got a new baby, but because that baby can't run, I'm not going to ever feed it. Well, you got to build it up. And if we don't have a mass transportation system in California that's really good and attracts the public, then, of course, the public will never use mass transportation.
Adrian Martin, I want to go back to you, particularly on that point, because I must confess I had a kind of knee-jerk internal reaction when you compared this to the state budget and funds. Where do you come up with that?
We estimate that the total cost to build the high-speed rail system that is proposed is over $80 billion, which is, as I said, close to 1 year's state budget. That's what I was talking about. But that gets to one of the limitations that Rod's not mentioning about this this bond initiative. This is only to build phase one, which is the San Francisco to L.A. line. The 1A funds are intended primarily for that. It's the other sections are eligible, but the other sections aren't likely to be built until phase one is going to be built, and phase one is going to need all of those funds, so that's kind of a red herring. The commitment on that bond is that they're not going to use those bond funds unless they have the federal funds and the private sector funds so that they have all the money so that they can build the system, so that they can build phase one, so that they can break ground in 2012 or 2013 or whenever. That's first of all, that depends. If we pass the bond, then the feds have to pass a big earmark for federal funding for this at a time when the Highway Trust Fund, which funds all of this, and the Transit Trust Fund, are running out of money. And the income from the gas tax is not paying for the current program, let alone any expansions of the program. And the private sector, which is going through all this economic turmoil you're going to talk about, is going to have to invest in this extraordinarily speculative project, which, according to our due diligence, does not pencil out. When the financial industry actually sits down and look at this, they're not going to invest in it. And so this is all going to be for naught.
Well, we should mention there's another $10 billion that would go into completing the network by adding extensions to San Diego, Sacramento, and Riverside County. But we have come to the end of this segment, and now it's up to you, the voters. And I want to extend thanks to both of our guests, Rod Diridon, who is Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute in San Jose, and Adrian Moore, Vice President of the Reason Foundation. They're releasing their report today on the California high-speed rail proposal, their due diligence. We're coming up on another half hour, which will take us to another California state proposition. Notification on abortions for teens is coming up again on your ballot. We'll talk about it when we come back. I'm Michael Krasny. And this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are continuing in the second half hour of our opening hour this morning, election coverage of California ballot initiatives, with focus this segment on Proposition 4, the Abortion Waiting Period and Parental Notification Initiative. Known to its supporters as Sarah's Law, the initiative would prohibit abortions for minors until 48 hours following physician notification of the minor's parent, legal guardian, or, if parental abuse has been reported, an alternate adult family member. And we want to talk about the proposition with both sides. And joining us here in studio is Margaret Crosby from the American Civil Liberties Union. She is an attorney with them, and she challenged the California law back in 1987, which required parental approval. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. We also are joined this morning by Dolores Meehan, who is with the Yes on 4 campaign. She's a fourth-generation San Francisco native and a volunteer spokesperson for the campaign and currently pursuing a graduate degree in philosophy from the Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology in Berkeley. Good morning to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you both for being here. And let's begin, if we may, let's begin with you, Dolores Meehan. This is something that has come up before for California voters. It's the third time in 4 years there's been an attempt to restrict access. Proposition 85, voters may remember, back in 2006, and Proposition 73 back in November 2005. What's the difference here? You're putting this in front of voters for a third time. Is there a difference?
There's a slight difference. First of all, just to clarify, it's not prohibiting abortions in any way. It doesn't restrict abortion access. It requires notification so that a physician, before he performs an abortion on a minor, who in any other service, medical service he provides, would have to actually get consent of a parent.
Right. Notify and get this approval.
It's notification. What's different, we listen to exit polls of people who are concerned about the proposition and built-in language that address their concerns, namely, of course, the judicial bypass has always been a part of it. The allowing an adult family member other than the parent to be involved in the case of reported abuse. That's new. That's probably the newest. That's really the functional difference.
The concern being parental abuse, of course. Yeah.
Parental abuse. Actually, in the event of parental abuse, we want to involve our court system. That's what our juvenile court system is for. And so the best case for Proposition 4 is actually made by those who oppose Proposition 4 that say, what about the instance of parental abuse? Now, the other thing when we talk about what's thrown up in our face frequently is, why are you putting this up the third time? Well, there's some really great laws that came about.
I was asking. I wasn't throwing it in
your
face.
No, I know. But it's frequent. People say, so you're at this again. Well, I might remind people that giving women the right to vote, abolishing slavery, didn't happen in one electoral cycle. And so this is something that when you think it's right, when it's common sense, and at the time, those two items were seen as sort of an aggravation on the electorate. But certainly when we look back historically, we say this was good. This benefited the common good of society.
So see a different argument. I mean, I've read the literature through the different campaigns, and there's a lot of emphasis this time on stopping and holding accountable sexual predators. Explain why that is.
Oh, that's huge. Well, in California, we have, as a port state, we have our kids are much more susceptible to the sex trafficking industry. In fact, the Department of Justice Organized Crime Task Force doesn't spend time catching gangsters. They go after sex traffic. Collectively, it's known as the human trafficking for the sex trade. We have a proposition on the ballot in San Francisco that thankfully Kamala Harris is opposing, which is to legalize prostitution, which is going to bring in. There's kind of a loophole that allows prostitution almost down to the age of 14. Kink.com is a pornography film company that's located in San Francisco at the Armory. The opportunities for young girls to be exploited sexually is increased in time.
And this would diminish that how?
Absolutely. Well, when the abortion remains secret, the abuse remains secret. Sexual predators will not be able to hide the evidence of their crime by having secret abortions. To date, not one sexual predator has been brought to prosecution by an abortion provider.
Let me go to Margaret Crosby. This, as I said, seems to be a rather new dramatic argument in the whole equation supporting this campaign. And what about the argument? Does it make sense to you?
No, this initiative has nothing whatever to do with sexual predators or with sex trafficking or prostitution or anything. This is a third attempt to restrict access to abortion. And it simply endangers our California teenagers. Of course, parents want to know and be involved in their daughters' lives. But most of all, they want to keep teens safe. And if a daughter can't come with the news of a pregnancy, any parent would want her to get confidential counseling and good medical care right away. And that's why the voters have rejected this twice.
And you're still concerned about abuse?
Absolutely, because I was in the courts for 10 years taking a look at the real-world experience with laws like this. And they may sound good, but in the real world, they put the teens from abusive families in great danger. What we see is that most teens do go to their parents. And that's true if there has been a conversation about sexuality. You know, these conversations have to take place long before a teen gets pregnant. But if a teen will not go to her parent, she usually has very good reasons for doing so. And so what we see in other states is that you have a number of pregnant teenagers, scared teenagers, traveling to court, presenting their cases before judges. In some places, the court system doesn't work. And in any event, it delays access to abortion. So we see the second trimester abortion rate among teenagers going up.
Because of the difficulty navigating through the courts.
Absolutely. The delays that any court process have.
But there are 35 states now that have these parental notification on the books.
That's correct. And that's exactly what our court took a look at, was the real world experience of those with those states. And they show that in many states, teens who can't navigate through the court system simply travel out of state, which also delays access to abortion. And then you have the teens who turn in desperation to dangerous self-induced abortion procedures. So laws like this don't protect teens. That's why the people who do protect our teens every day, the pediatricians, the nurses, the school counselors, the teachers, all of them oppose Prop 4 as they oppose 73 and 85. The signatories on No on 4 are the organizations who represent the people who work with our teenagers every day. Because they understand that you don't protect teens by erecting barriers to counseling and care. That really hurts
them.
There
are a lot of law enforcement people, though, who have joined up behind this proposition.
Not a lot of law enforcement people. There are a couple of law enforcement people. But let me say something about that, particularly Barbara Albee, who's one of their signatories, who was the author of Megan's Law. This is a really deceptive initiative. It was called Sarah's Law, and people should know there's more than one Sarah on the ballot.
There's a whole lawsuit over that, in fact. Yeah.
And Sarah, the story they tell is a sad story of a 15-year-old who died from a legal abortion. It is a sad story and an unusual one. What they didn't tell us is that there is no Sarah. There was a real Megan in Megan's Law. There was a real Jessica in Jessica's Law. There is no Sarah. The model was a teen who lived in Texas. In 1994, she was married. She had a child. Proposition 4 would have done nothing to protect her. No parental involvement law affects married women. So this really is deceptive. The other thing that's deceptive is this idea that this is really about family notification and family involvement. What the initiative says is that the doctor can send a state-scripted form to a relative who may not even live in California. There's no requirement that the relative help the teen, make sure she gets counseling. But the catch is that to invoke that option, she has to turn her parents into the police. She has to write out a narrative of all of the abuse she suffered, which the doctor immediately turns over to law enforcement. Now just think what a daunting prospect that would be for a scared pregnant teen. And if she does live in a dangerous and abusive home, she's really in trouble. The relative may say that she's turned them in. Law enforcement may not protect her. And so, as the Chronicle said this morning in its editorial, urging a no vote on 4, this is cumbersome to the point of cruelty in terms of our most vulnerable teens.
Right, we've come to a point where I want to invite you, the listeners, to join this conversation. We're talking about Proposition 4. We're talking to Margaret Crosby, who is opposed, and Dolores Meehan, who is in favor of the proposition. It'll be on the November California ballot, November 4th. You'll have an opportunity to vote either way. Now you have an opportunity to speak either way or to raise questions, and certainly we welcome any questions or comments you have. You can join us at our toll-free number, and that number is 866-733-6786. Lines are available to you. Again, feel free to join the program, 866-733-6786, or you can also join us by email, and the email address here is forum@kqed.org. Dolores Meehan, let's go back to a couple of points that have been raised here by Margaret Crosby. One is what she's called the deceptive use of Sarah's Law, no Sarah existing.
Well, of course, Sarah is a pseudonym to protect the confidentiality of the minor who
was
involved.
So there is a real minor, you're saying.
Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, this was brought to the ballot argument was challenged before a court in California, and the court upheld the right of our campaign to.
It was a Planned Parenthood lawsuit, I believe.
It's a Planned Parenthood lawsuit, yes, against the language, basically our entire ballot argument, And the court upheld our entire ballot argument without any change. So I think we can rely on the wisdom of the court and their due process that this is not a deceptive measure.
What about the other argument, though, that we just heard from Margaret Crosby, that a teen would have to essentially report her parents, and also that I think you would agree that with the dockets being what they are, there's a real difficulty navigating through the courts. So.
That's a great question. I'm glad it was brought up, because actually the way the judicial bypass is set up, the law mandates that the case be heard within 24 hours, the petition be heard within 24 hours. If the decision doesn't come down within 24 hours of that 24-hour period, so now we're talking about 48 hours, the court automatically grants a waiver of notification to the teen. So actually the failure of the court, in the event of the failure of the court system to properly watch out for the juvenile, for the minor, works in her favor. So there's not, we're not, and you mentioned that there's 35 states that have parental involvement laws. We're not seeing evidence that there's a problem. There's not cases being brought forward. We put a challenge on our ballot measure that said not one case has been presented that showed that a teen has been harmed by parental notification. We put a huge bullseye on ourselves.
Well, there has been a decline in teen pregnancies,
yes,
nationwide, and also, well, one could argue that this would increase the number of, not only decline in pregnancies, but also decline in abortions, that this could increase the number of abortions?
That's actually the opposite of what we're seeing. What we've seen is with parental involvement laws that we have not only a reduction in teen abortions, teen pregnancies, but also sexually transmitted diseases.
You've got the statistics on that.
Yes, absolutely.
And what do you say about the argument that this would force teenagers to essentially tell on their parents or inform on their parents?
Well, I think that if what we're talking about is in the exception, I think we all agree that most parents, the majority, overwhelming majority of parents, care about their children. And although they're communicating, and those same parents will admit that they're not necessarily being told everything their teenage kids are doing, but that doesn't mean they're not good parents. So when you so what we're talking about is a very small percentage of parents who are sadly abusing their kids. Don't you think somebody should turn them in?
Margaret Crosby.
Well, what we're seeing in other states is that teenagers cannot navigate through the court system. There are places where they get inaccurate information from clerks. Judges refuse to hear the cases. Judges refuse to grant the petitions. So although this says that the court must act within 3 days, by the way, not 24 hours, it just doesn't work, no matter what's on paper in many states. In California, I have great respect for our juvenile courts, but the fact is that they're severely overburdened with families in crisis. There's some large counties like San Mateo that have one juvenile court judge. There's some smaller counties that has one juvenile court judge comes, you know, once a week. And we all know that we don't have the budget money to increase the staffing for our courts.
We did a whole program on this, and you're right, it's woefully understaffed. But Ms. Meehan points out that there would be an obligation under the law to conform in terms of a time period.
Again, there's an obligation under every law, and yet we're seeing, we looked at this, we brought in juvenile court judges in our trial who testified that it was simply impossible to comply with these time periods. And think about California, never been done in a state like this. Think of the distances. A teen would have to personally travel to the courthouse, face an unfamiliar judge, prove her case by clear and convincing evidence. We have 100 languages in California. This isn't working in other states, and if anything, California is more complex. I want to go back to Sarah for a minute, too. The teenager this was based on, her real name was Jami Garcia Yanez Villegas. She was a married woman. There was absolutely no privacy. We found out about her because her name was in the newspapers. Her husband filed a wrongful death case. So to say that they are calling her Sarah simply to protect her privacy is simply deceptive. And I'd like to say finally that, you know, the proponents are saying to the voters that they've come up with a kinder, gentler constitutional amendment restricting abortion. But the fact is, it's the same old restriction on abortion that the voters have now twice rejected. And we're very optimistic that they will reject it again because it puts teens in danger.
Well, let's hear what some of these voters, at least our listeners, have to say. Most of them are voters. Nicole, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to speak to the discontinuing nature of this argument, and I'd like to illustrate that with a personal story. I was a pregnant teenager. I became pregnant at 16. I was on my own. My parents were not involved with my life. They were neither present and supportive, nor were they abusive. And I think that that's an area where most teen pregnancies fall under, that this argument is being framed as if there are only two types of families. And in my case, had I been restricted from getting the abortion that I did, I would have been tied to an abusive boyfriend for the rest of my life, either through having a child with him and giving it up for adoption or trying to keep this child and, you know, having to deal with some kind of shared custody or some kind of lifelong commitment to this person who was, quite frankly, poison to me. I think that the real-life cost of denying girls access to safe, healthy abortions is not addressed really at all in this argument.
Dolores,
I'd like to take my answer off. You know,
okay.
I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, Nicole, thank you. Nicole, thank you for your story. And I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry for that situation that you found yourself in. I want to clarify, this does not prohibit access. This does not restrict access. This requires notification. The minor receives once the abortion provider has notified the parent, has done his or her due diligence, the abortion goes forward. The parent actually, by law, can't prevent the abortion from happening. And in the judicial bypass, in someone in your case where you can present a clear and convincing argument, I think pretty easily, that your parents aren't involved in your life. And what we've seen is that in the 5 to 10% of judicial bypasses that have been pursued in the 35 states that have these laws, that this doesn't seem to be a problem.
Margaret Crosby.
Well, it's really unrealistic to say that there's a huge difference between notification and consent. From the perspective of a scared pregnant teen who lives in an abusive home, there really is no difference. If she fears a violent response, if she fears her parents will somehow act to block her access to the doctors, it really, from the perspective of a teen, there's no difference.
Let me get more calls on. Bill, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I think this represents a real abuse of the initiative process for the Right to Lifers to put this on every year now. I mean, this is like the third time in 4 years. They have failed to chip away at Roe versus Wade through the courts or through the legislature, so they keep trying to put this on here. And I'm really bothered by the fact that they seem to be getting more and more dishonest as they go along. I mean, I just heard your guest say that not one teenager has been harmed by these laws. Anyone who has access to the internet, just Google the name Becky Bell. She's the most famous case of a teenager who died in a back alley abortion because of these laws. She's famous because her parents are now lobbying against these laws, trying to stop people so that we won't have more teenagers being harmed by these laws.
No, Dolores Mahan, you were nodding your head when you mentioned that name.
Thank
Becky
you.
Bell.
Thank you for bringing up Becky Bell. You pitched that one over the plate for me. Becky Bell, the coroner's report showed that Becky Bell actually died from a spontaneous abortion, also known as a miscarriage, and that she was not actually pursuing an abortion. And this is a red herring case. The fact is, what I said is, not one case has been brought to us that has challenged us. Nobody has challenged us with a real life case that can go, that can show up to the due process of the law as being authentic, that says these laws have hurt.
Is that true, Margaret Crosby?
No, it's not at all true. The death certificate on Becky Bell did say that she died from a septic abortion. But there are many, many stories. For example, there was a pregnant teen in Michigan who was afraid to tell her parents, and so she asked her boyfriend to hit her in the abdomen with a baseball bat until she miscarried. She was hurt, and he was criminally prosecuted. And there's just story after story about teens going on the internet, getting drugs that cause hemorrhaging. But more than that, all of those teens who get delayed abortions, who get more complicated abortions, who have to travel out of state, all of them are hurt by laws like this, and none of them has helped. And talk about anecdotes. In the ballot arguments from the Yes on 4 people, they tell 5 lurid stories. Every single one of them is outside of California. We have had confidential counseling and care for teenagers now for over 30 years in California, and they can't come up with a single abusive story. That's why they had to go out and come up with this fictitious Sarah and stories from other states.
Well,
some
just
of
used
which
an example from Michigan yourself. I mean, you know, there are examples that are used.
Well, that's
from
right,
other
and
states.
We did not do that in the ballot argument because we relied on rigorous scientific research that showed the data that shows the real harm from these.
Which
I used
is actually
to. I told.
Absent.
I
there
told.
There is no scientific data, which is why you weren't able to use it in the ballot argument.
No,
so
wait.
So you relied on something. It sounds like you rightfully relied on data, but because it didn't exist, you couldn't provide it. And that's why you were not able to sustain your challenge before the California Supreme Court on what goes in the ballot argument.
No, wait a minute. First of all, the California Supreme Court said the evidence overwhelmingly shows that these harm minors. What you're talking about...
Let me finish.
What you're talking about is a Superior Court judge who said that he was troubled by the deceptions in the proponent's argument. But because the ballot argument is political speech, he would let it go to the voters and we could just fight out in shows like this. He did not say that anything they said was documented because it just isn't. It was very much about his role and the role of the voter's guide. But this is a deceptive argument. The San Jose Mercury said that this is the most deceptive initiative on the November ballot from top to bottom.
Well, let me remind listeners that we are having a rather passionate and heated debate here about Proposition 4, which will be on the November ballot and would amend the state constitution to require that parents must be notified before a minor can receive an abortion. I'm talking with Margaret Crosby and Dolores Meehan, and you're listening to Forum on KQED Radio. This is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio, so for more information about how to support this radio station, which we hope you will do and we appreciate, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me bring more of our callers in. And this is Sarah calling. Good morning. Whoops. Are you there? I thought. Sarah, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air. I don't know what's happening. Danny, see if you can. We'll try one more time. Sarah, do we have you there? No, I'm sorry. Okay, let's go to Penny then in San Jose. Morning, Penny.
Good morning. Thank you for having the show.
Thank you.
I was a minor that had an abortion, and I currently work in domestic violence in San Jose and as a counselor. And one of the things that we teach the perpetrators of domestic violence is socialization, the aspect of socialization. And my question is this. If a young woman has to fill out a form, a state-scripted form, to inform on her parents of all of the abuses that she is suffering at home, a lot of times young people don't realize when they're being abused at home. They think it's normative. They live in a home and they're raised by a family who may or may not be abusing her, but she's not necessarily going to know what to write down on a form that you turn into the state saying, this is why I can't go to my parents and tell them.
I think, Margaret Crosby, that's probably one of the arguments that you feel is salient here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we know that teens who live in abusive homes are powerless, really, to report their parents. We rely on doctors, actually, to do child abuse screenings, and they do that. They're mandated reporters, and they do, in fact, turn in abusive situations, either parental abuse or partner abuse. But the idea that to get health care, the teen has to take this dramatic step of writing out a whole story of abuse at the hands of her parents, it's just unrealistic. And by the way, there is no law like this anywhere in the country. This is something that was brought up by these proponents, obviously to sell something to the voters that they've twice rejected before.
Well, Dolores Meehan was shaking her head, naysaying here.
Right? Because this whole idea of mandated reporters with regard to abortion doesn't work. This fails. This fails the protecting the safety of our young girls. Let's look at the just most current case in the California Supreme Court with Gary Cross, a 39-year-old stepfather who was sexually abusing his 13-year-old stepdaughter while his wife, her mother, her parent was at work. And he brought her twice to Planned Parenthood, who did not investigate what was going on. Why is a 13-year-old girl pregnant? Let's look at this. Why is a 39-year-old man bringing in a 13-year-old girl? He then was told that her abortion went to 5 months. Planned Parenthood would not perform the abortion because it was too late. And so he brought her to San Francisco General Hospital. She was then given a late-term abortion. Nobody there notified her mother. So this whole idea of mandated reporters. There's another case with Allen versus Planned Parenthood where Planned Parenthood very successfully argued before a judge that they could not be held responsible for their employees' failure or their failure to comply with mandatory reporting laws. If they're actually reporting and they're actually fulfilling their obligation to be mandated reporters, why did they have to argue that before a judge?
Let me bring more of our callers in. Steve, you're on. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to take us back a few minutes to a comment that your guest who is pro Proposition 4 made in regards. She was saying that, organizations like or companies like Kink.com were going to be bringing in and sex traffickers and participating in abusing minors. And I actually know some people that work there, and they're my friends. And I know the guy who actually runs the company, and they would never do anything like that. They are some of the most ethical people that I know.
All right, we've got some testimony from you on that score, and we thank you for the call. I don't know if we want to necessarily get into that rat's nest here,
yeah.
But you'll pass on that.
All right.
Well, let's go to Sarah then. Sarah, I don't know if this is Sarah we lost before.
Yes, it's the same one.
Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if the use of the pseudonym Sarah was not disingenuous, or at least from a marketing angle, why it was that a Latina name wasn't chosen as a pseudonym since the ostensible victim was Latina. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you.
That's a great question, and I don't have an answer for you. I don't think it was intentional by any means.
Well, we're going to conclude here with that enigma, because we've come to the end of the hour. Why the name Sarah as opposed to Inez or Juanita or something along those lines? But I want to thank you both for
a
spirited and very devoted to your cause debate here. Dolores Meehan, again, by the way, owns and operates her own financial and accounting consulting business and is a volunteer for Yes on 4. Margaret Crosby is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. We are coming up another hour forum. Christopher Buckley will be with us in the hour ahead. I hope you'll join us for that. Thank you for joining us for this hour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.